Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by the journalist and broadcaster Michael Wilson. Michael got his start at Thames TV, becoming one of their leading current affairs reporters and creating The City programme. Moving to Sky in 1989, he founded their business coverage, and over a 20-year career with the network reported on every significant world event, from the fall of the Berlin Wall to the financial crisis in 2008. During that time, he also worked at ITV, where he founded and fronted GMTV's NewsHour and successfully broke early morning TV viewing records. Now a presenter at Arise News and Jazz FM, he is also the UK's longest-serving business and economics editor. He's won Broadcaster of the Year in 2005 and is co-author of Fixing Britain, The Business of Reshaping Our Nation. Michael, thank you for joining me.
Pleasure.
You're a Scarborough lad, aren't you? How does a lad start in Scarborough and then end up presenting all the business coverage on Sky?
Because I had the great advantage of going to something called Scarborough Boys High School, which was a sensational school. We all did our things there and we wondered whether it was all worth it. But the great thing about Scarborough Boys High School was this grammar school thing. I have a big thing about grammar schools. I resented the fact when they were semi-abolished, you know, a number of years ago. What it did was it gave people like me a real leg up, because had they not been there, my parents wouldn't have been able to afford to send to public school and the rest of it, and to university. But it was this great bridge. It was a wonderful social mover, really. And the whole thing about Scarborough Boys High School was that they said you were going to do this, you're going to get your O-levels, you're going to get your A-levels, and you are going to go to university. And where else in 1967, 68 would you want to go? You're going to say to me, Oxbridge, I wasn't quite bright enough for that. So London, when it was rocking and rolling, that's where I... So that's how it really happened. But it was all down to that schooling, and also down to a family background. Both my parents were writers, and I was surrounded by books and all that kind of stuff. I was surrounded by people who wanted to get in rock and roll bands at the time. It was... Scarborough was... I know it sounds weird, but in fact, Scarborough is such a polite place that the tide knocks before it comes in. Did you know that? But it was a really, really good grounding in getting into academia and into getting your O-levels and A-levels, which would then project you into university. So to answer your question, that's what happened.
And did you always want to be a journalist?
I did, but unfortunately at the time, there was this catch 22, right? So I got my degree from King's College in London, English Language and Literature. Useless, of course, you know. But I wanted to go into journalism, but the catch was that you had to be a member of the NUJ to get into journalism, but you couldn't be a member of the NUJ unless you'd worked as a journalist. Complete catch 22.
Or chicken and the egg, I would think. It's the
well,
same thing, isn't it?
Exactly, yes. So the answer to that really was to go and work on the Rochdale Bugle and Clarion, you know, for 2 years, get your indentures. And there was no way, with all due respect to Rochdale, that I was going to leave London, which was so unbelievably squeakingly trending at the time. So I had to work out another way of doing it. So what I did then was, and I wanted a flat in London, because I'd come out of university, and the only job I could get was in a bank. So I worked as a management trainee with NatWest. It was a total and utter failure. I was useless. And then I went to work as I went to work for Westminster Hospital as a... That all sounds strange, doesn't it? But these were really great people. They were doing things in the health service then that should have been done now. It was fantastic. I was then 22, quite idealistic, so doing all my social stuff. Then I went to work for Help the Ages as a press officer, which is a whole other story which you don't have time for. But gradually, I was beginning to see that I could sneak into journalism if I played it properly. So what I did was I got a job finally through an advertising agency where I was writing a lot of copy into IPC Business Press, as an assistant editor on welding and metal fabrication. Have you heard of that?
I have. I contribute to it regularly. Of course we do.
And then there was the next one was with a company called Morgan Grampian, and it was called Metalworking Production.
But you were a business journalist at this point already.
I decided then that was the way to go. What you've got to do in life is have a niche. Now, it may sound dull, but at the time, industry was rock and roll. They were talking about the white heat of technology. They were talking about chips, not the fish and chips kind, but InMOS, making these little chips in this country, which were going to change the way we all work. And they did. And I thought, well, that's quite a good way in. And it was quite nice. I used to go on trips to Eastern Europe, you know, before the Berlin Wall came down, and meet all these funny people and the spies and all the rest of it. Quite seriously, all this stuff used to go on. And we used to put it into a trade journal. The weird thing was there was this old bloke working for welding and metal fabrication. He read Russian. He used to get reports from the Russians written in Russian about the state of submerged arc welding in Russia. You're looking at me bored. Should I tell you why?
I'm not bored. I'm absolutely enthralled.
So, from that...
Why did he get these reports?
Well, indeed. I don't know how he got them, but he used to pass them on.
No, why? Not how?
Oh, no. Why? Well, because he was the person who could put it in the magazine because it was about welding. But the real thing that was going on is if you could calculate how much submerged arc welding was going on, you could find out how many submarines the Russians were building. And he used to pass it on to the intelligence services. So that was all there, anyway. So that was me.
And did they give him? A couple of Little Chef lollipops?
No idea.
Thanks,
and luckily, he is long and, God rest his soul, dead now, so I don't know. But that was the kind of thing that was going on at the time. But that was quite exciting. But anyway, so that got me into working with paper, working with print, you know, working as a journalist. So that's how I did it. And then the NUJ joining was absolutely fine.
The best TV journalists, I feel, are always the ones that started in print. Would you agree?
I happen to think that is one of the most important things that ever happened to TV. And I think it's one of the most important things that's missing right now.
Well, the people get a degree straight in broadcast journalism and then go straight into Austerlitz.
It really is a waste of time. You need to sit down at that, it used to be a typewriter, obviously, but at that keyboard and write a story and know what a story is and know what the structure of a story is and know how to interview people and have all that print training, which now doesn't happen, but it should. You're absolutely right. Couldn't agree more. And that's what used to happen. So that television in its early days used to hire the best out of Fleet Street. There were a few people who would get in through Oxbridge, you know, by the, you know, BBC traineeships that were going last year. But
the kind of David Cameron-esque levels of connections.
Correct. And us little northern boys, of course, didn't have that. But no, that you're absolutely. If there were more people still going through that kind of system, and we can come on to talk about Fleet Street later on if you wish, but if they were going through that system, life would be, journalism would be so much better. You're absolutely correct.
So at this point, you never fancied being front of camera. You were always going to be sitting in front of that typewriter.
Okay, so what I wanted to do after I'd done the sort of trade mags was to work on the FT. And I got in contact with, his name escapes me now, but he was the industrial editor of the FT. And he was such a nice guy. And I wrote to him and I said, I'm working this and I want to work on the FT. And I went to see him and he was so helpful. But again, there was a slight Oxbridge barrier before you could actually get into that kind of thing. And then I went to a party. And I met a young lady, as you do, and she was working for Thames Television. And she said that Thames Television, to keep its franchise, was looking for a business programme. It was going to be called Inside Business. So I got in touch with the big boy at Thames TV, and I said, my name's Michael Wilson. And fortunately, you know, it's so weird. He answered the phone and said, hi, Mike. And I said, no, I don't think you know me. He knew somebody else called Michael Wilson. How weird is that? Anyway, So I was straight through to him. And I said, look, I'd like to apply for the job. So I sent him my CV and I went for the interview. And the head of Thames Television, he was a big bloke, come from Panama, called Peter Pagnamenta. Those who know about television will know, you know, big name and everything. Mm-hmm. So we're sitting around for the interview and say, so have you got any programme ideas? And I said, yes, I do. And there was a bit of a silence. I think, why should I give my programme? But yes, I do have ideas. That's why I'm here. I'll give you one. Chips. So they all laughed and said, what do you mean fish and chips? Like you're from Scarborough. No, no. I said, no. Electronic chips. This is where the action is right now. Oh, yeah, okay. And we should also do something about industrial espionage, because that's quite a sexy subject, isn't it? You know, given the Cold War and all that. Oh, yeah, that's quite good. So there was I, 19, I think it was 79, finally made it into Thames Television. Do you know who the most important person in Thames Television was? It was a woman called Jane who was on reception.
Yeah, Jeremy Vine always says the receptionists
it's
are the most important people.
Absolutely true. And Jane would, A, cover up for you when you went out for lunch too long. She sorted out the cars and she was an altogether wonderful, wonderful person. So here's little Mikey, right? The first day at Thames TV, a little researcher. I promise you this happened. So Jane, whom I'd known for a while because some of my friends had been in there working on various television. So I used to chat with them. She was lovely. And she said, is this your first day? I said, yeah, it is, Jane, actually. Yeah. She said, oh, OK. I've got two people I'd like you to meet. You know, I said, OK, yeah. Eric and Ernie, this is Michael Wilson. Can you believe it? Eric Morecambe, Ernie Wise, sitting on the sofa in the reception at Thames Television. And there's little Mikey.
And how can you crowbar them into a business programme then? Because that would have been an amazing story.
It would have been, wouldn't it? I was so embarrassed. I said, oh, thanks so much. Lovely to meet you. Love your programme. But there we go. So that was the Pandora's box that was about to open.
And presumably then, that was the first rung on the ladder to inevitable TV stardom.
Yeah. I mean, that was... So Thames was the place... I mean, there was the BBC, but that's... I've never worked for them in television terms. And everybody in the world knew where Thames Television was. It was an absolute... We used to call it Lord Thames. I mean, you'd go any country in the world and they remembered Benny Hill because it was on Thames TV.
I always think of Rainbow, the opening sting, didn't it? Before the Rainbow theme started, and the Thames.
Well, they had the skyline of London rising up, didn't they?
Yeah.
And will you buy my sweet oranges or something like that? You know, this kind of London cries. Yeah. So on the first day I worked there, I was taken under the wing of the senior researcher. And she said, well, we're going to interview somebody from the Department of Trade and Industry now, so you can come along and see how it works. Oh, thanks very much. So we did. Anyway, we get there, you know, down on the Westminster, wherever, Whitehall.
Was it Victoria Street, is it? Was it the DTI?
Yeah, one of those. Yeah, exactly, Victoria Street. So we get down there, and she's there, and there's 13 crew members, plus the reporter.
Those were the days.
Those were the days.
Now you have to shoot it on your own iPhone.
Well, they were all there. So we get to the office, and the bloke's out. The minister is actually not there. And I thought to myself, so all these people have turned up. I would have sacked the researcher. But anyway.
I would have trashed the place and then just stopped off.
I kept my silence. So she said, well, there's a bit of a mistake. I said, quite. And then this really other lovely young lady came up. She got a clipboard. And she said, well, we're going to lunch now. I said, okay, so I'll see this. No, you're coming to... What?
Free lunch. You got the lunch.
In a restaurant, right?
Wow.
So there's, I think, probably 14 of us in a restaurant, the crew. This is a daily programme. Okay? And the electrician's there. And we had to wait until the electrician finished his lobster thermidor before we could go out and shoot the afternoon's interviews. And I thought...
Times were tough back then.
I love this. This is brilliant. You know, eat, drink for free.
Yeah.
You know? And be on the telly. What could be better?
But you weren't on the telly at that point, were you?
No, I was just in the back. So,
but you had ambitions to be on the telly.
I wanted to show off. Yes, of course.
You got the show off gene.
Yep. And so what happened then was that Thames News, which was the daily programme, was looking for a reporter. And I went down to see the editor, and he said, "So have we ever heard your voice?" And I said, "No, you haven't." Have you got an experience? I said, no. So I said, I've got an idea. Okay, so I haven't got any experience in this kind of thing. So what time do you lot start in the office? He said, well, 7 o'clock in the morning. Okay, I'll be here at 7 tomorrow, and then let's see what happens. Okay, and if there's a story, send me out on it. If it works, it works. If it doesn't work, nothing lost, okay? So he said, fine. So at 7 o'clock in the morning, there I was, trembling like a big one.
But bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, no doubt.
I was so... scared, Anyway, so and Time Out. Remember the magazine?
I do. Still going?
Well, there was a strike by the Time Out gents, so they sent me down to cover
the strike.
Yeah, to cover it. That's right. And I remember I thought, right, now most of these reports start with a big kind of "It's Michael Wilson here reporting on a strike." So what we'll do is we'll go to the door and knock on it. That'll be a bit of actuality, right?
Mm.
And then it's Michael Wilson, Thames News. What's going on, right? So up to the door.
Good visuals. I like it.
Everything's going on. So camera's rolling and all the rest of it, right? Up to the door. Bang, bang, bang. Hello, it's Michael. And the sound goes, sound not running. I thought, oh, Jesus. Can't do this again. So I had to retreat.
But I thought they called you One Take Michael.
Well, no, it was my fault that time. It was One Take Wilson.
Right.
But so anyway, so we did it, and that was and I was on, and it was fine. And from then and then finally I got the job there, and it was a question of pushing through, and that's what you do.
So tell us about the next stage then. How did you go up a rung on the ladder?
Okay, so I did a year and a bit working on the news programme. And
then, as a reporter?
Yes, right, yeah. And then I presented the programme as well at the Thames News when Andrew Gardner, the great late Andrew Gardner, was off, did a bit of that. And then they did a half-hour regional opt-out programme called Reporting London. So I did a bit of that as a reporter on that. And then the next thing was to work on the nationwide thing called TVI, which was their current affairs programme. So there was like Panorama, the Granada one, and then the Thames one. And I got a job on that, working as a reporter. And it was being presented by one of the Dimbleby's, Jonathan Dimbleby. And unfortunately, once you have a level of Dimbleby's above you, there was nowhere...
You can't break the Dimbleby ceiling.
No, and a lovely guy, and I love him dearly and all the rest of it. But that was it. That's where they were going. So I'd done everything I could possibly do as far as current affairs and news in Thames was concerned. And it was fantastic. And then my editor on the Reporting London programme and I had a very good lunch, because you could do that in those days. And trust me, it was really nice.
There was budget for lunch, was there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely there was, yeah. And we were sitting in his office with our feet on his desk, probably having a cigar. Probably shouldn't mention that, but we probably were, who cares? And we looked out of his...
I wish I was a TV reporter in the 70s. This sounds awesome.
We looked out of the window and I said, you know what? There's this thing, isn't there, called Big Bang. What the hell is that about? I'm a business journalist. It's about the city. Why? And this new bloke was coming to Thames TV, David Elstein, right? He'd been at Thames, you know, the Wunderkinds and all the rest of it. He'd been away, come back as programme controller. Why don't we give him a new programme? And we thought of a programme. We thought the City programme. And that's where that started in 1987, just after Big Bang. And talk about the zeitgeist. I mean, it was a brilliant idea. I take credit for a bit of it. And Terry Kelleher, who was the editor, we both did it together. And it couldn't have been better. It was on, can you imagine this? It was on at 10:30 on a Thursday night after ITN News. I don't know how much money that made for Thames Television at the time, but I wish I'd had a part of it. I didn't, but it was fantastic. And I then got absolutely fascinated by the workings of the city.
Was the stock market at that point a kind of world of top-hatted gentlemen brokers?
No. It had been. The whole point about Big Bang was that the top-hatted gents had the barrow boys of the East End to deal with. So the top-hatted gents, as you put it, had the reputation of the city in their hands, but the real dealers
were the barrow boys.
And it was a meeting of these two cultures that made it so sexy that the Americans came in, the Japanese came in, other Europeans came in, and those little trading houses, which were making megabucks, got to make incredible megabucks after all those. Everybody wanted to work in the City of London. And why not? It was money for old rope. So that's the programme we did. It was amazing a time. Big mobile phones, like bricks, you know.
I can remember those big mobile phones because they had a shoulder strap, didn't they? Because the batteries were so big. I remember them. And people used to have a separate car phone as well. So you'd have on a business card, it'd say mobile phone and then car phone separately.
All that, yes. It was a wonderful time. And it's actually defined a great deal of what the city does today.
Did you ever have a kind of tiny bit of, not envy, but where you thought, you know, some of these guys are making serious money and I'm making a reasonable living covering it?
Yeah, you're damn right I did. But,
because you still had to drink in the same wine bars, didn't you?
You did. But the thing that I didn't really want to go to work at, 5 o'clock in the morning and kill or be killed right through the day. I mean, that's what these traders were doing. And it's when you see them work, it's pretty serious stuff. I mean, there's a lot of them that don't do a great deal, but the big boys who make the big bucks actually live by their wits all the time. And I'm basically lazy. And I thought, well, it'd be lovely to have, but it didn't do it for me. I was happy to be able to report on it and just feel the atmosphere of what was going on.
So how did Sky News come calling then? Tell us how you got there. Because, I mean, you were there for decades.
Yes.
I mean, I grew up watching you on Sky present the business news. You were the face of business.
So round about, November 1988, it was about to start. And I was getting a bit restless at Thames at that time, because I said to you I'd done everything that I could do, apart from the Dimbleby thing, which wasn't available for a Wilson.
You were at Dimbleby. Scarborough.
Good luck to him, but that's what happened. So... anyway, so Sky started, and I thought, this looks actually quite fun. And I worried a bit about it, because Murdoch at the time had a bit of a besmirched reputation.
Because it could have failed. I remember we were one of the Sky pioneers in my household. We were one of the earliest viewers.
Well,
and there was a big thing about, this probably will go. And BSB at that point were doing the square reel, and they might have won.
So here's what happened. So as far as I was concerned, it was starting. I thought, I quite like to do this. And I met a wonderful Australian bloke called John O'Lone, who was head of news at Sky. And Nick Ferrari, he was the news editor. He was at The Sun. He went there.
And never heard of him.
Nick and I met in a boozer, and we discussed terms. And I said, all right, I'll go and have a look at Sky. And I finally signed up for them. I joined them just after they started in February 1989. Just after.
Plus, you weren't part of the launch kind of lineup then?
No, because I was just late, that was all. I mean, I had to work out my notice period at Thames Television, but I'd already agreed to go.
Our old friend Bob Friend started on day one, though, didn't he?
He did, yes, Bob did. Yeah. Oh, no, lots of them. It was amazing. You have to give credit to the Aussies. I mean, they did it. And you talked about BSB. There was no way that they were going to do it. It was a British company full of people who were earning a lot of money. They had fantastic headquarters, Marco Polo building, the rest of it. Murdoch set this ramshackle cowboy thing up in Isleworth, which is, you know, not the nicest place in the world. Mm. It was in porter cabins, basically, but he got it on the air on the date. He said he would get it on the air. BSB were floundering all over the place and nothing. And everything was stacked against Sky. I mean, the whole of the broadcasting establishment was against it. For me, it was amazing. We were like, it's like the Wild West. We invented so many things that people actually... Do you know that before Sky actually got the football contract, which is another major, major thing that happened in television, television coverage of football matches didn't used to put the score up on the screen, in the top corner.
Yeah, the little graphic.
It was Sam Chisholm. Yeah, I mean, it was all that kind of stuff. And that's the kind of thing we were operating in. So it was a bit ropey at first. So it did two really major things, right? Presenters on the major channels had basically been actors. You know, there were a few journalists, but not many. Right?
There weren't journalists.
No, not really, no. At Sky, there were a lot of those people who joined, first of all. Sure, you know, continuity presenters and all the rest of it. But actually, the good presenters became, or forced to be presenters, the journalists themselves, because they had to. They had to drive what was going on. It was driven by the producer and director in the gallery, and it was driven by the presenter as well, which is actually quite an important change in television that Sky actually started. The other thing they did... Now, I may be proved wrong by the first section of this. I think that Sky invented the pool thing, whereby one reporter and one crew goes to interview X, Y, and Z, and then they share it between us. But one thing, I think that's right. It may or may not be. But I know what they definitely did was they used to go to areas where, of course, the film crew would be stopped at customs of the place in conflict, and everything would be confiscated. They used to send people in with bits of camera, bits of equipment, which would then be assembled on site. So somebody would take...
Clever.
Yeah, you know, it was all that. And it very, very... There was a woman called Jackie Faulkner who was in charge of technical operations. She was absolutely brilliant. I hope she's listening to this. She was fantastic. She arranged all that kind of stuff. They used to get into places that nobody else could go in. It was such a brilliant thing to be involved with. It shook everything up and we were doing exactly the right thing. If we were wrong, we were never wrong.
It was all game over.
Never wrong for long. No, I mean, in terms of the coverage, because it was rolling news. And I cannot understand why anybody else... Does television rolling news apart from Sky? What's the point? They've got it.
If you say never wrong for long to people at Sky now, they really do frown. They don't like that. They will say that was 20 years ago and we've moved on. And
yeah, of course they have. No, they haven't.
All that gubbins.
No, it's good for a laugh. No, kick them. I don't mind at all.
I mean, I've got Sky HD and they've got on one of the channels, they've got that Sky Vault where they've got the very first broadcast and it had Alistair Yates and I think Penny Smith presenting
that's right,
the first
one. Yes.
And I actually watched the first half hour of Sky, rewatched it. My wife walked in at the time and she went, "What are you doing? What kind of saddo would watch Sky News for like 30 years ago?" But I found it fascinating because, I mean, there's people that were on air then that are still there now, people like Kay Burley. Mm. I mean, how long were you there for?
20 years.
20 years is a long time. I mean, because there were so many pioneering things within your coverage as well, like being based actively in the city and not just in some kind of studio that's notionally in the East, as it were. And I remember, you know, the very early incarnations of Sky Studio actually had real journalists working in the background rather than it just being some static thing.
Yeah, they did. I mean, there was a big thing about those that were working in it would say, apart from Sky, say you can't actually shoot a newsroom through a window. Well, yes, you can. So we did. And that was one of the things as well. I think that may have been an Australian thing. Certainly John O'Lone would have pioneered that. But it showed that it was like a bit of a machine going on as well. I mean, basically, that place at Isleworth had no natural light whatsoever. It was a bit depressing, to be honest. And we just had these sort of, you know, odd little lights here and there. Mm. But they did that because they wanted to say, you know, this is like a working news thing. Somebody actually once almost, I didn't think it was terribly because I thought it was a bit naff, but almost had somebody rushing in with a piece of paper, you know, to stick it under the presenter's nose and say, you know, latest news. I thought that was a bit naff because you didn't need to do that because you got your earpiece in so you knew what was going on.
But even changing the manner of kind of news presentation, because I remember you'd have the studio, then you'd have the newsroom, and then the back there'd just be the wall, and then you'd put some televisions on the back, and that kind of evolved into the news wall, where it would become a separate thing that you would actually present.
The news wall was a graphic invention, and it gradually got better and better and better, and I think everybody does it now. I mean, we used to watch in the early days of Sky, you know, the German presenters on ZDF, it was called, like standing up and doing news. You go, oh, look at those people, idiots, standing up behind a desk. And then sure enough, we did, you know.
Yeah.
And then we begin to sit down again. I mean, there's no such thing as a new idea. But certainly, we felt we were breaking ground. And what we did know was we were being copied by everybody who laughed at us. That was the great thing about Sky.
Imitation is the most sincere form of flattery.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you did 20 years there. What did you feel it was time to move on after that then? What happened?
Yes, I mean, I did. I also worked at GMTV within that time as well, which is setting up something else, which was quite fun.
I'm going to ask you about that in a second.
All right. Well, I mean, after 20 years, I did. I felt it was time to do other things. And also, I guess there's a sort of thing where you think, well, can I do anything else? You know, when you're sick, I was 60 then, you know, I thought, I think I should be doing it. I'll, you know, do a book or something like that.
You're 60 then, Jesus, you look good now.
Well, thank you. And work on other things. So that was the thing. I mean, I suppose I could have stayed, but I just felt at the time it was right to do something else, you know, get a shower, as it were.
So when you left Sky, you went to GMTV, didn't you?
I did, yes. And that was in 1992. It sounded like another great idea. And, you know, that kind of, I was like...
You were doing the news hour, weren't you, with Fiona Armstrong?
Yeah. Well, I started off doing the presentation with Fiona Armstrong, and they felt it didn't work, and the ratings went down from what TVM had done. And I said to them, you know what, this is just like... it's like a party, really. The party's going on, but the hosts are different. Of course people move away. What's the big deal? Anyway, they didn't get that. So I said, OK, what would you like me to do? And they said, well, the big thing is between 6 and 7 in the morning, we don't have much of an audience. So I said, well, why don't we do a news hour? And Reuters were also the news providers at the time. So that's what we did. So I did a news hour for GMTV for 2 years between 6 and 7, which got, quite a considerable number of viewers, actually. I mean, you know, I say that myself, but I mean, it's like 1.5 million, which is actually quite a big audience, isn't it, that time in the morning?
It also did quite a bit to improve GMTV's reputation as a broadcaster, because a lot of the later stuff in the segments from sort of 7, 8, 8 o'clock was kind of light-hearted, show-busy, lifestyle-y type stuff.
Yeah, I think, I have to say, I mean, if I were doing it again, I'd do exactly the same. I think it's quite right that you sort of harden things up between those kind of hours, because you assume that, I mean, we'll come on to the way that television works and news and all this of it in a sec. But I think it was quite a good idea to have that kind of hard-ish news thing and then go into the softer stuff and get the soap stars on, because it works. People like to watch that kind of thing.
Tell us about what you've learned about the business world covering it for all these years. Do you think that, you know, a lot of them are wrong-uns? Is there a personality trait that you think where you see someone and think, yeah, I can see why you'll succeed in business? And what are the ingredients?
I think the best business people have got Asperger's. They have a complete attention to detail. They're not really worried about being socially good or bad, and they get on with it. A lot of the leading business people are not very good with grammar, but they are very, very good at seeing an opportunity and actually seizing it. And very few of them can actually explain their mojo, like a great guitarist. I mean, you see something, you know, you went to B.B. King and said, hey, B.B., you know, how'd you play the guitar? Like I do. You know, it's all that, isn't it, really?
Mm.
I think there's a sort of personality about business people, the really successful ones, that keeps them away from the herd, if you like. In terms of wrong-uns, yeah, sure there are. I'm sure there's wrong-uns in journalism. I'm sure there's wrong-uns running that pizza bar around the corner from where we are right now. The one thing I think about business is this, that it's the only thing that provides tax. Nothing else does. And tax is what drives the country. Nothing else does. And unless you can think of something, I can't. I mean, loads of people work in the public sector. That's fine, all the rest of it. That's got its good and bad, as we know. But business is the thing that keeps the country going. And unless you have a sensible business climate in a country, then you might as well give up.
Well, the only other source of funds for any government is borrowing, but that's just deferred taxation anyway, because ultimately it'll have to be paid back. And how is it going to be paid back? Through revenue, which is taxation generated by business.
Correct.
Do you think that the government is too hard on business? I mean, I've run business for a couple of decades now, and, you know, you get these people that pop up on the telly saying regulations too much and it's discouraging people. And I think, well, it isn't. And besides, I don't care how complicated the VAT form is, I'm still going to get up on a morning and want to run my business. It wouldn't put me personally off.
I mean, we're friends, aren't we? I mean, you're an exceptional person. I mean, you know, that you're a very good businessman. I think it does
steady
put
on,
people.
But...
No, I think it does. I think it does put people off. And I don't think that anybody can tell you the following about running your business. Okay, so there's three of you, two of you with a fantastic idea. It goes, your turnover goes up. You've got to employ somebody else. Then you've got to employ somebody else. Then you've got to employ somebody else. Then you're up to 100 people. Your turnover is a couple of million, right? Puts you in a separate kind of tax thing, doesn't it? Then you've got to think about national insurance, pension. So a businessman like you, are you going to get help from the government? I mean, I present this program for Jazz FM, 6:30 in the morning, business program. And one of the regular items is the help lines and the web pages that's down to help, you know, small businesses.
So, I declare that I am a listener.
Thank you. There's now two. My mum does this too. But, you know, those kind of things are quite important, but they cannot actually legislate for everything. You need to be able to think for yourself, and I think that takes a particular frame of mind. So I think the government can sort of, if I had my way, I'd have the government stand back. Hmm. Obviously, less taxation. I believe that if there's less taxation, you get a bigger economy. There's a thing called the Laffer curve, which is in the United States. Right? So Professor Laffer was one of the advisors to Ronald Reagan. Now, you might laugh at Ronald Reagan, but he actually surrounded himself with some very clever people. He lowered taxes in the United States, and lo and behold, the GDP went up because Professor Laffer said, if you tax people more, they'll work less or they'll go. And there is a kind of level at which you don't want to raise taxes anymore.
Let me ask you that in a kind of media question, as it were. Do you ever optimise the story for your audience? So, for example, you've got an issue about the pensions and the collapse of BHS.
Yeah.
Do you think, would you present the story differently for your business section, the business segment, or do you think, well, it's still a business section on a generalist news channel and therefore I'm going to make it more about the pensioners themselves rather than about the entrepreneurs?
No. Very good point. No, what I try to do is the most difficult thing, which is simplify. I assume that my mother is listening. Now, she's 95 years old. She lives in Yorkshire. She's not stupid. She's not a businesswoman either. But she is one of those kind of people that will be interested if it's interesting. So that's what I do. I try to make it as accessible as possible. And I don't care whom I sit down with, whether it be analysts from the city, chief executives from any company you like. If I'm talking to them, I say, what simply are you trying to do? And simple is the most difficult thing to do in the world.
It is, because you've got to get to the essence of a story. And even if it's a business issue, it's still got to be a story.
Yes, it has. Yes, and I mean, I've listened to, I remember talking to somebody who worked on the Today programme on Radio 4 years ago. And they used to regard business as being like an interesting phenomenon. It's quite worthy of looking at from the outside. Instead of saying, this actually means something to you. And it does. That's the whole thing about business. It means something to all of us. It means something to you. It means something to me. It means something to everybody who is employed in this country or is an employer in this country. The only people it doesn't mean a great deal to are people who work in the public sector. But then they need to be educated. Their money isn't free. They think it is, but it ain't.
But do you think there's a lot of effort now to try and make business coverage even more accessible? For example, I listen to Wake Up to Money on 5 Live.
Yeah.
And, you know, even though they'll do the big business stories, they'll then say, oh, yeah, so there's been this record company merger. So text us and tell us what your favourite David Bowie song is. And you're thinking, why are they trying to shoehorn populist text into a business programme?
I don't doubt you. If that's true, I think that's trivialising it. There's no, you know, heaven's sake, you know, in this great capital city, you get a taxi. The bloke driving the taxi knows more about what's going on in the country than you and I do, doesn't he? Or she. I mean, generally speaking, they might just have a crass opinion about something, but I bet a load of them know about what's going on. I would never, ever do that kind of thing to a business programme. Just turn it round and say, why am I listening to this? I'm going to tell you why you are.
They say that kind of taxi drivers know when a recession is coming beyond anyone, because it's one of the first things that people cut.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a PR guy. PR is also one of the things that people cut when they're starting to feel that they need to tighten their belts. Do you get a sniff of things quite early on, like a sixth sense when you know a crash or a recession is coming?
Not a crash, no. I mean, I don't think anybody can predict that kind of thing. A recession, well, I'd look at the taxi queues outside Waterloo Station when I go home, and if they're going right down the ramp, then that says something, doesn't it? And the obvious things are boarded up shops and so on. But I don't think anything more than that. I think you kind of look at what prices are doing. And if prices are gradually going down as they are right now in terms of staples like food and so on, you think to yourself, yeah, well, there's a big battle going on out there to fight for people's purses, which is actually probably quite a good indicator.
Because you actually wrote a book, didn't you, about the post-recession world?
Yes, it was with Digby Jones, and I co-wrote it with him. And I approached him and said, do you want to do a biography? And he said, well, no, somebody's already doing it. You know, I said, oh, okay, fine. And then we chatted to each other, and then I suddenly thought, wait a minute, you know, to be honest, you know, you've done all the stuff and everything. Why don't we do something about what you feel about where Britain ought to be headed? Because he's the boy, isn't he? I mean, he'd done the CBI, he works as a trade minister, so he's seen the UK nationally and internationally and so on. And, I mean, they were his ideas, not mine, but I sort of moulded it into the book with him.
And what was the impact?
Well, it did extremely well at the time. I mean, I'm no great expert on books and publishing and so on, but it did well. And I think he was very well received in what he did, which is quite right for the time.
Anyway, back to your career. So you did Sky, then you did GemTV. What came next?
Then back to Sky. And I did the longest, but that was from about 1994, I think, to 2009. Just doing the general coverage then, budgets and all the rest of it. And it was a really good time. By which stage, and I think Sky had got up to about 10 million viewers. I think the churn was down to a reasonable level. So
what was the longest time you had to ad-lib for with no auto-cue? Because there was nothing, no VT lined up.
About an hour, really, when we were doing... I was doing the breakfast programme. There was a... Do you remember this? There was a mortar attack on number 10 Downing Street.
I do remember that, yeah. John Major was Prime Minister.
Yeah,
he was chairing a cabinet meeting and he just said, gentlemen, we're going to have to reconvene somewhere else.
So we did about an hour of that, which is great fun, actually, because you've got it all there. I laughed when another Dimbleby, I think, was talking about doing the budget a few years ago, and he had to do 2 hours with the Mars bar. And I mean, you know, going on air and we did 24 hours on the general election. I mean, it was, you know, it just depends what you actually think. And you've got to enjoy it. You've got to have a laugh. And all the stuff's coming in on the wires. Your computer's there. You know, there's people yakking in your ear about what's going on. There's video coming up. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. It's like flying.
But David Dimbleby looks great after 9 hours of election coverage, whereas Adam Bolton always looks completely knackered. Do they need to give him another Mars bar or more water or something?
Hey, he's a great bloke, Adam. No, I mean, it's... no, I couldn't possibly comment.
So what are you up to now, then, and what's next?
I launched a channel called Arise, which is a global news service which is aimed at Africa.
I've been on it. I've been a guest on your show.
You have, which is a fantastic idea. One way or another, that there's an audience. I just did my 3 years and then I left in December. But there's the great thing about Africa is it's generally unreported. There is a kind of feeling that it's full of corruption, poverty, you know, falling governments, crappy currencies. Yeah, of course it is. But what people don't get is the fact that there is an amazingly rising, nascent middle class which needs to get decent news. And the majors kind of do it, you know, but they don't really concentrate on it. So that's something that I'm going to address. I love doing the jazz thing as well, which is the weirdest thing in the world, a jazz programme with a business programme between 6 and 6.30 in the morning.
Hey, it works.
It's the only commercial station that has a business programme on it. Can you believe that? And it's got a fantastic ABC. I'm not advertising jazz, this is what I mean, but they've got a fantastic ABC One audience and they do things with the FT and so on. So I think that's a great. And the thing about jazz is, if anybody's listening to my programme, they're not doing it because it's on by accident, they're doing it because they want to. It may be niche, but it's cool niche and I quite like it.
It's quality. It is.
Well, thank you.
And where does this passion for Africa come from? Because, I mean, I remember having lunch with you a few weeks ago and you went on about Africa for a long time. It was incredibly interesting. But the passion that you had, you know, for the projects that you're setting up there, yeah, was self-evident.
I've travelled relatively widely in sub-Saharan Africa, mainly. Weirdly, my rock and roll band played in Malawi about 20 years ago.
I didn't even know you had a rock and roll band. And I thought we were pals.
Well, no, it's gone now. But, I mean, it was fun at the time. Well, prick up your ears if you really want to know. I think it's still on the web. Anyway, the one thing I was fascinated by, the people that you meet, there's this intense optimism about the most horrible places you can... I mean, I was in Liberia. You know, you don't want to go to Liberia.
I didn't even know Liberia was a real country, because Michael Jackson did that Liberian Girl.
Yeah,
that was my first introduction to that company.
And actually, so there's a country which had these horrible years of civil war.
Mm.
And I went there and I met a bloke who'd been a child soldier there. And we sat down and talked about things. And I said, well, just what we did. His name was Adam, 9 years old. Can you believe it? When I met him, he was 12. And he was our guide around Monrovia.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah, but, you know, but the thing is that you could see that this kind of little businesses were all springing up everywhere. Now, this sounds as if I'm being patronising, but it's not at all. I just find those kind of things so amazing that in the midst of all that stuff, when a country like Liberia is being torn apart by the minerals companies and all the rest of it, we're pouring so much rubbish into the rivers. That's all now, I hope, stopped. They're building homes and they're building hospitals and they're trying to get an economy. This is just one of which combines helping people as well as taking the minerals out of the country because it's got to make money one way or the other. Those kind of calculations are, I think, absolutely fascinating. And I think Africa's got a lot of that. I mean, there's everything's. It's too big to talk about in 5 minutes. It's obviously such a big place. But when you see these little things starting, I just find that fascinating.
Penultimate question then. Tell us about the best time you've had in your career and the worst time.
Yes, I'll tell you what. Actually, yeah, I do have one worst time. So I'm working for. I'd been at Sky for 2 years. Right. I'm presenting the breakfast program with Penny Smith. The wires come in, it's 9:45, and it says Thames Television, where I used to work, has lost the franchise.
I remember that.
Right. It's 9:45. Embargoed until 10 o'clock.
Did Carlton win it in its
place?
Yeah,
they did. That's right, yeah. Anyway, this says embargo till 10 o'clock. And I looked at it, and I thought, oh, Jesus. And that one person I thought about was Jane on reception, because it had been her whole life. And I was so sad. And I said to the
because it meant Thames would close, didn't it?
Yeah, game over.
There's no reason to exist.
Ned, gone. And I said to the, are we going to break this? And he said, yeah, break it. And I said, it's in bugs. I don't care. Break it. And I was the person, first person to break the news that my old employer, where I'd had 10 amazing years and met these fantastic people. I mean, I can't tell you, you're a young lad in there, you know, and there's these national broadcasters and the rest of them who would happily sit down with you and tell you what you should do and what you shouldn't do. And you copy them, copy how they did the voiceovers, copy how they wrote their scripts, copy how they wrote a picture, all these kind of great career things. And this thing was just gone like that. You know?
Did they deserve to lose it, or was it all political?
It was all political. It was all about a programme called Death on the Rock. That TVI did.
I remember it, yeah.
Remember, was
the
it
IRA.
Yeah, exactly. And there was this great kerfuffle about the army, you know, going to shoot IRA people in Gibraltar. I never saw what the fuss was about, to be honest. But anyway, it was, you know. And yes, it went. And that was my worst time because I felt I was saying something horrible about the people I'd worked with. And I loved them all. I mean, I had a fancy. That was the worst.
Best?
The best bit, I think, was either interviewing Elton John, who came in special on a Saturday before he went to his Watford football match at GMTV. And Elton had just got his new hair. And so it was...
Oh, he'd had that hair weave, hadn't
he? Yeah, that's right. And he had his personal hairdresser with him. We're in makeup, right? So I'm with one of my heroes, little Mikey is with one of his heroes, and I'm just thinking, I love this bloke, you know, and I'm going to interview him. What do you say when somebody's having their wig done?
Sing me goodbye, Yellow Brick Road.
Well, so I said...
Rocket Man?
Well, yeah. And
Candle
I
in
was,
the Wind?
I was struggling. I was struggling for words. And I was just saying, so you looking forward to the football then this afternoon, are you? Are you going to Watford? And he said, yes, I am. And we had a fantastic interview, and I loved it. That week, because we just started, I did Tom Jones, which was great. Shy man. Gosh, so shy. And his hair looked like, you know that stuff that you get in a Chinese restaurant, the seaweed? Mm. It is all badly dyed. And of course, now he looks amazing. It was, and then Tony Bennett. Can you imagine? I'm sitting next to Tony Bennett.
Wow.
Interview. And we talked. Luckily, I could find somebody to talk because he had got a fantastic piano player, which I know a bit about. And those are the interviewing those kind of people.
Musical heroes rather than business heroes.
Was absolutely the best.
Last question then, because we're about to be thrown out of the studio.
Okay.
What advice would you give to a youngster who's embarking on their career that wants to be the next Michael Wilson?
Okay, so get a niche. Get a speciality. Read the Financial Times. If depending on what age you are, get articles done in your local free sheet, because that's what local newspapers are right now. Get yourself into seeing how a newsroom works, however you do. No matter how small it is, it's all about the pressure and all about sticking stuff down on a page. And then ring up somebody who works for a television company, and there's loads of television companies, a webcast, honestly, and just get an idea about the equipment. But get a niche and then really be enthusiastic about it. Television, if that's what you're talking about, is a people business. If you're grumpy, if you're an idiot, you know, I was going to say, no, I wouldn't say that. But you know what I mean? It'll be fine. But if you can just connect with people and be the person who brings in... I'll tell you what, editor used to say, tell me something I don't know. That's what you do.
Michael, you're one of my favourite people. You know that. Thank you ever so much.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things.